From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. We're very thankful for that. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, November 23rd marks the Christian feast of Christ the King. Monday, Sikhs observe the martyrdom of Guru Tegh Bahadur. Wednesday will be the Baha'i Day of the Covenant. And two interfaith holidays will be celebrated on Thursday, Thanksgiving and a marathon of NFL games to aid indigestion. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief.
Have you got the notion from pop culture that science and religion are in constant conflict, like two rival boxers vying for the title of heavyweight champ?
Why is there this ongoing one-sided tension between science and religion in our country? From evolution to politicizing climate change to, I think we can say now, ignoring research to push an anti-LGBT agenda, the religiously driven conservative right seems bent on fanning the flames of a conflict that many of us thought was pretty much resolved once the church came to terms with Galileo. The answer to why may be hard to find. But a strong indicator of how important it is to pursue dialogue between science and religion is a long-term initiative from the illustrious American Association for the Advancement of Science, the world's largest general scientific society. The Perceptions Project operates under the auspices of the AAAS Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion. And on this week's show, I'll talk with Dr. Jennifer Wiseman, who heads up that project.
Christianity will never be the same again is actually a beautiful and wonderful, and I would say divinely inspired opportunity and not a catastrophe. We have succumbed to the misapprehension that Christianity is primarily about what we believe. But the goal is to encourage you to be less Christian and more Christ-like. And I want us to be desperately passionate, breathlessly passionate, about the pursuit of being more Christ-like.
When a man named Christian authors a book titled Post-Christian, one can be forgiven for asking, is it a religious book or a memoir? Although I'm certain a memoir by Christian Piatt would be fascinating reading, the full title of the book at hand is Post-Christian, What's Left? Can We Fix It? Do We Care? And it's a wide-ranging examination of the moral and spiritual opportunities of what the author labels the post-Christian era. Can the Christian faith better itself even as it weathers what is widely seen as a decline? You'll hear Christian's answer on this week's State of Belief Radio. But first,
this Humanum Conference in Rome, sponsored by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, at which leaders of all various religions, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, Catholic, are coming together to talk and share with each other their witness to the marriage of a woman and man and a family.
About gay marriage. One of the well-known speakers on CNN asked me, said, Rick, as a pastor, do you ever think you will ever change your opinion on this? And I said, no. And he said, why? And I said, because I fear the disapproval of God more than I fear your disapproval.
In the United States, those who promote what they call marriage equality have unjustly appropriated the language and mantle of the black struggle in the United States, the civil rights movement. But there can be no equivalence between blacks' experience of slavery and oppression and the circumstances of homosexuals.
Amen. Western culture now celebrates casual sexuality, cohabitation, no-fault divorce, marriage redefinition, and abortion rights.
The goal of the conference, which is being held at the Vatican, is to highlight that marriage between man and woman is tied to the fate of humanity, and that it is crucial to protect for future generations. Marriage between man and woman should be supported by all institutions, because it is not only a religious issue. It is a union that strengthens society.
Hot on the heels of the Roman Catholic Church's at times controversial synod on the family last month, an interreligious who's who of conservative faith leaders have descended on the Vatican this week for an international colloquium titled The Complementarity of Man and Woman. The event itself, its guest list, and remarks Pope Francis made this week have led some commentators to express dismay and disappointment at what they see as a culture war love fest. Others have dug in their heels and insist Pope Francis would never backpedal on what they see as his relatively progressive stance on human relationships. Hopefully able to offer some more nuanced interpretation, Sister Janine Gramick is a Roman Catholic nun and co-founder of New Ways Ministry, a gay-positive outreach to LGBT people of faith. Sister Janine, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, well, I'm very pleased to be here, so I thank you.
Talk, please, about the colloquium that happened at the Vatican this past week and why it got your attention.
Well, it got my attention, of course, because of my work with LGBT people over the years. I've been in a ministry for Catholics in particular, but all people who are LGBT and their families and friends. So, of course, it got my interest because the colloquium was about marriage, and I'm a big advocate of marriage equality. But the people at this colloquium were talking more about marriage between a man and a woman.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of those individuals who you say look at Pope Francis and say he's backpedaling, I think he's not backpedaling. I think he's being true to his own beliefs and his instincts. I don't think we, those of us like myself who are advocates for LGBT people, should be looking toward him to change doctrine. And so our evaluation of him and this conference surely depends on our hopes or our presuppositions or what we would like to see. Does that make sense?
It does. What do you make of the fact that it appears that no LGBT names were on the list of those included for this? Does that bother you?
Well, it certainly bothers me. It doesn't surprise me, but it does bother me. One of my hopes and what I'm working toward is because I've put some feelers out or put some buzzes, you might say, in some cardinals' ears, is that we could have LGBT people at the Synod in October of 2015, just as at the Synod, the Extraordinary Synod that was in Rome in October of this year, which was about the family, there were married people present, heterosexually married people, because marriage and divorce was was on the agenda, but there were no LGBT people present. So my goal is to try to see that there are LGBT people present at the Synod on the Family in October of 2015 in Rome. But it doesn't surprise me that at this convocation there were no LGBT people speaking.
This may be a big question, but what have you heard from the colloquium that disturbed you, and what have you heard from the colloquium that encouraged you?
Well, I'm certainly disturbed by the fact that we continually speak of marriage in terms of male and female. What I think is more encouraging is to talk about what I see is the essence of marriage, which is love, commitment, devotion to a person. Francis, our Pope, has talked about LGBT people who are caring for each other, and a number of cardinals have made similar remarks. So statements like that are encouraging. But what disappointed me is the emphasis on man and woman.
I see. And I'm curious as to what you get from LGBT people watching what's happening and listening to the news, because what Pope Francis has said about not passing judgment on other people, what he has said in statements of respect for people in disagreement with him, a lot of LGBT people, I think, as well as a lot of us generally, have read that as support from Pope Francis, and honestly, it may be his compassion, and that we have thought that that compassion was going to take it farther policy-wise like we hoped, and maybe we were wrong on that. Is that right?
I would agree with you in what you said, that many people have interpreted his kind remarks, his compassionate remarks, as an indication that doctrine will change. I don't think doctrine will change, but policies will change.
Mm-hmm.
We have seen policies already changed in the sense that some bishops here in the United States that are known to be more conservative, or in my view conservative, but perhaps others would label them middle of the road,
mm-hmm.
They're making more compassionate statements.
Mm-hmm.
So the harsh rhetoric will change. Also, what we are seeing is that on the parish level, on the local level, pastors are becoming more welcoming to mm-hmm. lesbian, gay individuals. So these are policies. It doesn't indicate any kind of change in doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
I think what Pope Francis is saying, not I think, I know that he's saying, because he's said this in his apostolic exhortation, The Joy of the Gospel, he's saying, don't be concerned about the doctrine. Be concerned about our actions and what we do and how we treat each other.
Mm-hmm.
So those people who are hoping or expecting that Francis's kind remarks and kind words will translate into changes of doctrine,
mm-hmm.
that I think is unrealistic.
Sure.
As I just want to repeat, it's unrealistic, but I think this Pope is saying it's not important. Those things aren't important. I mean, when you think of what our Pope, this Pope is saying, this, as Christians, we need to follow Christ, who is the mm-hmm. the one that we believe in. Christ had no doctrines, had no sexual doctrines.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good way to put it, and I think you understand that people who are not in the Catholic tradition may have trouble distinguishing between policy and doctrine, but you have made the distinction very clear. I'd like for you, before we go, to share the premise of New Ways Ministry and how folks can get involved in your work.
Surely. Well, New Ways Ministry is a national and at this point international Catholic organization, and we are really devoted to reconciliation of the institutional church and LGBT people and their families and friends. And we do this mainly through education, because we feel that the real problem has been homophobia and heterosexism, and we need to educate people about those two realities so that we can have a more accepting and inclusive church and world. And people can get involved if they can please go to our website, www.newwaysministry.org. That's N-E-W-W-A-Y-S, two W's in there, and then ministry, M-I-N-I-S-T-R-Y, all one word, .org. And there will be a host of things there that they can participate in. We have conferences. We have retreats. We're doing a pilgrimage in February to Rome and Assisi to see Pope Francis and Saint Francis,
mm-hmm.
the two Francises.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a host of activities that they can participate in. But one thing I would like to leave your listeners with is we are encouraging people between now and next October, when the bishops will gather again for the ordinary synod on the family, mm-hmm. to write to the Catholic bishops to express their views, and really to tell their stories. Do they know people who are LGBT? Are they LGBT themselves or family members? And what has been their experience? It's so important that bishops hear the stories of LGBT people and their advocates.
I think that's a wonderful idea. And as we move forward, I think we need to have you on the show again and talk some more about that. Sister Janine Gramick.
Thank you. Thank you. I would love that.
Sister Janine Gramick is a Roman Catholic nun, co-founder of New Ways Ministry, a gay-positive outreach to LGBT people of faith. Sister Janine, thank you for what you're doing. Your work is important, and thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, you're most welcome.
It's a pretty Washington-sounding title, the Project for Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. But the actual debate at the crossroads of science and religion, as it's currently taking place on a daily basis in our culture, is nothing short of existential. Increasingly, we hear voices raised on both sides demanding loyalty to one or the other, and if the voices aren't always obvious, there are other expressions of this tension that are no less influential in guiding our values and policies as a nation. So I am really delighted to be able to welcome Dr. Jennifer Wiseman, who is a director of the AAAS Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion. Dr. Wiseman, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Would you please briefly summarize the mandate of DUSER and of the Perceptions Project?
Okay, sure. So this dialogue program was conceived about 20 years ago, long before I had ever heard of it, by this major scientific society in a recognition that many people in the public who want to be appreciative of science are also part of religious communities. So mm-hmm. a good way to enhance dialogue between scientists and the public would be to improve dialogue between scientists and religious communities. So hence the birth of this program called the Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion, which is really designed just to get people communicating about science issues that are mutually interesting. So, like I say, that's been going on about 20 years within this scientific society. And then for the last few years, this program has had some specific projects that mm-hmm. are really designed to engage with a lot of people out in the public and are quite interesting. So you mentioned one, which is this Perceptions Project, mm-hmm. which is one of the activities we have going on, and this is designed to investigate just exactly what it says, the perceptions that people have, right or wrong, about scientists and science, especially people in different religious communities, and likewise the perceptions, right or wrong, that scientists have about them, mm-hmm. because sometimes it's these underlying perceptions or stereotypes or whatnot that can prevent constructive conversations about science. So we've been involved with this effort for the last couple of years.
How do you and your colleagues talk about the potential for common ground, given the fact that there are some people who seem dedicated to promoting a conflict between science and religion?
Well, that's quite interesting. I mean, I'm not a historian, but it's quite interesting if you look into the history of this whole public discussion about science and religion. There are interesting historical books that talk about how the birth of what we might call modern science some centuries back there was no sense of discord between science and religious faith. That was, in fact, many of the founding scientists that we look to now as kind of the fathers and mothers of science were motivated in some sense by their faith to do the science. I think especially in this country, in the United States, much of the seeming discord became more into public consciousness about a century and a half ago, so kind of the latter part of the 19th century when it was sort of seen or discussed in certain books that maybe religion was sort of hampering the advance of science. And then likewise, from some religious circles, there was discussion that maybe science was in some sense in conflict with biblical faith. So these are things more for historians than for scientists to understand in depth. But what we do as scientists is not try to tease out all of the deep philosophical challenges about discussing the relationship of science and religion. We're about getting people to talk. So what we do is bring people to the table who have a common interest in something that's going on in science and technology these days, and then have these different perspectives be brought into conversation. It really is quite fascinating. I mean, when you think about how science and technology are impacting every part of our modern lives today, it is not something that you can kind of place in the corner and say, you know, that's science over there. I mean, everything we do, our agriculture, our communications, our healthcare, education, everything we do today in modern life is somehow impacted by science and technology. And we need to be talking together as society about the impacts of these things, both good and bad, and the ethical challenges that are brought forward by our advances in science.
Dr. Wiseman, I couldn't help but smile when you said you were here to make people talk, because the people that I know that are so much trying to support a divide between religion and science love to talk. They just don't like to listen. And so I'm curious as to when you bring these representatives of faith communities together, what is that like?
Well, some of the things that we try to do, again, we're a society of scientists, so we're interested in what's going on in science. By the way, my own science is astronomy, so that's what I particularly enjoy. But what we try to do is bring a topic together and then hear about how this is interesting to people for different reasons. So, for example, we could talk about neuroscience. Like, what are we understanding these days from the science perspective about how the brain works and how our thoughts are come forth in the brain, how our behavior may be governed in some sense by neural processes? And so that's an interesting scientific topic, but then it also impacts our discussions of behavior and why we make choices and the things that we do. And of course, that then brings into interest people who are interested in ethical responsibility or religious communities that are interested in our responsibility for our behavior and our choices. It's always helpful to know what's going on in science as a piece of these bigger questions that are going on. So what we tend to do is have events where we will you know, tell people what the state of the art is in the science, but then hear discussions around the table or in the auditorium or whatever we're doing from people of different walks of life for whom what we're learning in science may have a different type of interest or impact. Another type of symposium that we had is one on environmental care, where scientists could present how they're learning, what they're learning about our environment as a whole. And then there are many religious communities who actually have a heart toward what they call creation care and want to do things to care for creation, care for it for the earth, and not just for its own sake, but to help especially people in developing countries and places where the environmental health has such a huge impact on the quality of life. So is there a benefit to bringing the scientific knowledge of environmental stewardship to alongside people who are in faith communities who really want to get their hands dirty helping people? And that brought a lot of interest. So that here we have a common interest bringing together people from faith communities, churches, and so forth, as well as scientists. They may not all see eye to eye on theology or anything like that, but they see eye to eye on service and on good use of knowledge. So that's another example of bringing people together around the table around a common interest.
What's been the biggest challenge for you in leading this project? Because I know that some religious people stereotype scientists as not caring about religion. Do you have to get over that hump, or what's been the big challenge for you?
Well, that's quite interesting. That's, again, one of our projects, as I mentioned, is this Perceptions Project. And for that, we really did it. We've done our homework. We did a major survey of 10,000 people from different walks of life and different religious faith communities to find out what their thoughts were on scientists and also what people in scientific careers thought of, think of people in religious communities. Mm-hmm. And these are overlapping communities. So one is to realize that there are, in fact, scientists who are religious believers, so these are not totally separate communities.
Mm-hmm.
For religious communities, many don't even have said that, especially more conservative religious groups, have never even met a scientist. They don't know,
right,
or they don't think they know scientists, and so it's kind of an alien world. And so what we've discovered, however, is actually there are quite a few people in science careers within those communities.
Right.
They just hardly speak up about it, so people
right.
don't even often know
yeah.
that. Or often they don't realize that maybe pursuing science could be seen as something that's in keeping with their faith, you know,
right.
something that is a positive thing of gathering more knowledge and understanding. For scientists, I think many of them likewise feel like they haven't necessarily met very many people who are strong religious believers, although it turns out that a lot of times there are such folks in their midst, they just don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And scientists, believe it or not, our biggest response to our dialogue program and the things that and the programs that we do from the scientific community, by and large, the overwhelming comments I get from scientists within our society is, this sounds really interesting. And these are from scientists, regardless of whether or not they have a personal religious faith. By and large, these scientists from across the whole spectrum come to me and say, this sounds really great. I want to be involved in this conversation with broader society. I want to be a part of this conversation. What can I do? And so what we've discovered is that there are people, both in religious communities and in scientific communities, who really want to have more conversations with each other, even if there's not agreement on all the scientific issues, but at least to understand each other's interests better. And there's not a good architecture for that. So,
right.
So what we're starting to do in some of our projects is just create little one-day workshops or luncheons or things where people can, from these different facets of life in a community, can actually get together and just meet one another and learn about each other's lives and issues as kind of square one for improving dialogue, so that it's not just abstract discussion of science and religion and ethics, but it's discussion between scientists who are human beings.
I love that approach, and I like talking with you. I'm out of time. I want to talk with you some more. Dr. Jennifer Wiseman is Director of the Dialogue of Science, Ethics, and Religion at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And Dr. Wiseman, thank you for taking the time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The last time Christian Pyatt was on the show, we were talking about the risks of lumping persons who self-identify as spiritual but not religious under the broad label of nuns. He's also been on State of Belief talking about his book, Banned Questions About Jesus. Always audacious and always deeply thoughtful, Christian has published a new challenge to readers in the form of a book titled Post-Christian, What's Left? Can We Fix It? Do We Care? With the assumption that that title refers to the faith and not to the author, I'm happy to welcome Christian Pyatt back to State of Belief Radio. Christian, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me back on, Weldon.
I just can't get away from the first lines in the book. You said that people were going to be upset about this book, and you're probably right. I've read it. It's a terrific book, and I can see why some would be upset. You kind of wanted them to be upset, didn't you?
Well, in a manner of speaking, yes. I feel like people should be provoked or at least a little disturbed by the book, which is one reason when Tony Campolo came out with his endorsement that said it's an important book but very disturbing, I thought that was a great endorsement.
Yeah.
Because what I'm doing is challenging a lot of precepts and assumptions about Christianity that I think people have kind of held at the core of Christian identity that I believe is not necessarily what should be at our focus. So, you know, that's going to be feel a little bit uncomfortable for some people.
Right. Well, I want to start by asking you to answer your own questions that are in the book's title. What is left? Can we fix it? And do we care?
Right. Well, I think the good news is that the things that are left are the essential core tenets of Christianity, which are faith, hope, and love. And the fact is that those things don't necessarily need Christianity as an institution to survive as it is today in order for them to still endure and manifest themselves in the world. So in some ways, by having a lot of the institutional and traditional systems challenged or even crumbling in some ways around us, it actually gives us permission to let go of those things that aren't life-giving and that actually we've been putting a lot of resources, good money after bad, into sometimes, rather than really focusing on living out those things that Jesus calls us to. There are some things that we don't need to fix. I talk about welcoming the refiner's fire, so to speak, that some of these things that are being burned away need to go away. We need to welcome that because it actually is freeing us up to do more gospel-centered work in the world. And I think as far as do we care, although fewer and fewer people do care about the institution of religion, it's a very consistent concern of people's and preoccupation and of people in the world and in the United States in particular to pursue a more deep understanding of God, understanding who this character of Jesus is, and understanding what it is that gives us real meaning to our lives.
You know, I appreciate in the book the recognition you give to people whom I suppose many folks would say are non-religious. I was thinking about when you were on the show before talking about the nuns. Would this book appeal to the nuns?
I think it absolutely is aimed at those who may be de-churched or unchurched or suspicious or even damaged or hurt by institutional religion, or just maybe have grown up in that culture where we don't really feel like we owe the institution the same things that preceding generations before us who assumed that there was inherent goodness in institution. And so I think for them, to give them permission to seek God, to live out the gospel, and to have an even intentional community and practices of worship and study and discipleship that aren't necessarily confined by the traditions found in Christian institutional religion, I think is very permission-giving and liberating for some who might identify as spiritual but not religious, for lack of a better term.
And my sense was in asking that question to myself, I saw it just as you do, very positively, because I think that people who have been hurt by religion and people who are in that category of the nuns are going to be far less defensive in reading the book and more open to what you're saying.
Yeah, and I think that that's really commonly where I end up being, where I am offering kind of comfort and reassurance and hopefully an open invitation to those who have felt on the outside of religion and a challenge to those within it.
Yeah, good way to say it. In Post-Christian, you present the seven scandals of Christianity. Would you say something about those, please?
Sure. They're roughly based on the seven deadly sins, but they're sort of paraphrased, if you will. So you've got the Christian scandal of greed. You have the scandal of judgment, fear, and so on. The one that I think surprises most people is the Christian scandal of certainty. And I spend quite a bit of time talking about that in the book, that I believe we've become addicted to certainty about our beliefs in Christianity, and that's become a very dangerous thing.
Yeah. You also offer the seven virtues of Christianity. What do you say about those?
Right. For every Christian scandal that I present, I try to offer a Christ-like virtue. So I'm inviting people to be less Christian in the sense that, like Gandhi once said, you know, I like your Christ, I don't like your Christians. Your Christians are so unlike your Christ. Well, then let's try to pursue not being more Christian, and let's just focus more on being Christ-like. And what would that look like? So I balance those scandals with a Christ-like virtue. So we have humility, we have generosity, love, courage, and sometimes they may not look exactly the way you think. For example, when I talk about love, it's not this sort of warm, fuzzy, feel-good kind of thing. It's the thing that lays you bare and makes you most vulnerable to the most powerful force in the entire known universe, I believe, which is love. It's not just something meant for good. If love is directed in the wrong way, it is a deadly weapon. And so it is availing ourselves to the power of love and whatever way it will have with us. And similarly, when I talk about the Christ-like virtue of courage, some people think of that as sort of the doubling down in the culture wars, a more militaristic or aggressive kind of courage. But I'm actually calling people more in the Brené Brown sense, the courage to be vulnerable and laying ourselves bare to those who might seek to do us harm. And I think that that is the only way that we really earn the right to be heard and to be understood as those who are trying to pursue this vision of what it means to be more like Jesus in the world.
This is a debate we hear frequently in our culture. Some say religion is essential to keep humanity civilized. Others blame religion for the worst atrocities in history. So, on balance, looking back over the past 2,000 years, which side wins in your mind?
Well, actually, in my book, I say that both sides, I think, are out of line. But at the same time, both sides have some element of truth to them. I think if we focus exclusively on the ills that have been exacted on the world in the name of religion, we actually miss the point, because that's kind of like focusing on guns, you know, rather than just the people and the way that they're using guns. You know, the institution of religion itself is an inherently amoral system. It depends on how we use it. It only has the amount of power that we afford it. And so I think what we really need to do is we need to reorient our priorities, because I say that we've actually come to worship the false god of religion. We have actually venerated it above God and the gospel itself. And in that way, we have given it undue power over our lives and the world. And so in that way, we need to put it back in its proper place, where it is serving a means to an end rather than being the means to its own end, which I think is evidenced by the fact that, you know, we can look, for example, you see that the Catholic Church in North America alone has a budget of approximately $40 billion. And yet the United Nations Food Aid Organization suggests that it would take only about $7 to $9 billion a year to eradicate hunger from the face of the earth altogether. So the critics are right to level some judgment of hypocrisy toward us, because we obviously don't fully have our priorities in order. And so there's some reorienting that needs to take place. But I think just to inherently say carte blanche, we need to throw religion out altogether, I think is to be a little bit reactive.
Christian, I was impressed by the way you use the terminology post-Christian era. I think it's important for people to understand, especially when hearing about the book for the first time, that's not a phrase that you use wringing your hands in despair. It's actually, as I see it, an opportunity to remake Christianity in the image of Jesus. Is that right?
That's absolutely right, because what we're really talking about here is post-Christendom, or the end of Christian hegemony in the Western world, the end of Christian dominance. And I know that for some, it feels that that is our sort of divine right, the sort of manifest destiny made real. But the fact is that I believe Jesus' followers wanted him to do something similar and basically, you know, enter into Jerusalem as a triumphal victor and to basically take over rule and establish a new kingdom here on earth in that way. But the fact is, as Walter Wink says, if all we do is change the rulers and not the rules, then nothing really changes. And Jesus, I think, saw that we needed to subvert those systems of rule and dominance entirely, rather than just changing the figureheads. And so in that way, there is a revamping of Christianity that needs to be done. And I think being in a position of less dominance in the culture is actually a good thing for us, because it gives us a healthier perspective on where Jesus wanted us to come from in the first place.
We've alluded to this already, but I want to pick up and look at it more closely. There's a tension in Christianity today between conservative and progressive forces. We just saw it play out at the Catholic Synod of Bishops in Rome. Young evangelicals are challenging their churches on social issues. Where does this tension fall in relation to the idea of a post-Christian era? Because both sides clearly value their vision for Christianity very intensely.
Yeah, and I think the problem comes not so much in which positions we take, but when we value our ideology over the fellow humanity of our brothers and sisters, or whether when we elevate certitude, the importance of being certain and right about what we believe over having community with someone who may be different than us, I think that's where the real violence and the real problems and real divisions come from. And, you know, it reminds me of when my wife and I started a church in Southern Colorado about 10 years ago, and we had somebody come and they said, well, you know, I don't really believe the same things you believe. Is your goal here to make me think and believe more like you? And I said, no, what my hope is that we will cultivate a love among us that is greater than our differences. So I don't necessarily think we all need to see things the same. I think it's actually good that we have pluralistic views within the greater body of Christ. But the thing is, we need some stronger connective tissue founded in love and mutual trust that actually allows us to have those differences and still stay together at the table. I think that's really what we've been missing in the ideological warfare that's been kind of putting us at each other's throats for far too long.
Christian, when someone picks up this book and reads it, what is your hope that they will think or feel by the time they reach the end of it?
Well, I hope that if they are coming from the position of sort of feeling like they need to sustain or protect organized religion, that they'll feel a little bit of permission to not focus quite so fiercely on preservation of that. I think if they have felt on the margins, which is a big demographic that I speak to a lot, people on the fringes of Christianity, nominally Christian, spiritual, but not religious, that they'll feel that the table has been expanded just a little bit and that there is indeed a place for them in that space, and that they will enter, regardless of where they're coming from, that they'll enter into some serious personal inventory, if you will, both individually and collectively as groups, about what it really means to follow Jesus, what the differences are between belief and faith, where these sort of where certainty festers and manifests itself in our daily lives, and where it wreaks havoc in our relationships and our pursuit of a more holistic embodied faith. So those are the kinds of things that I hope people will, I hope they'll feel challenged, but also in some sense reassured that that the things that Jesus were trying to remind us were important are fortunately not dependent on us to sustain in the world, that they will be here long after Christianity is dead and gone, if that happens to be the case. So I think there's more at stake than just religion itself here. And I hope that's reassuring for people and not just scary.
Christian Piatt is the skillful author of the thoughtful new book, Post-Christian, What's Left? Can We Fix It? Do We Care? Among his other books are those in the Banned Questions book series, including Banned Questions About the Bible and Banned Questions About Jesus. I hope you pick up this book and read it. It's going to surprise you. You'll laugh some. You'll scratch your head some. You'll have to think some. And you may even be more attracted to the truth of this book than you anticipated when you started reading it. Christian, I always enjoy hearing your original take on some of the most important questions facing religion today. It's a valuable book, and I appreciate you being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. I always appreciate the opportunity.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. With Thanksgiving coming up on Thursday and a long weekend is going to knock a lot of people out of their regular routine. So I want to ask you to be sure to tune in for State of Belief Radio, because we'll have an all-new episode for you this time around. Next week, we'll look at how today's battles over religious liberty in this country compare with the freedom the Pilgrims were actually after when they landed at Plymouth Rock, with Dr. Peter Gardella, author of American Civil Religion, What Americans Hold Sacred. We'll also be discussing the way Native American spirituality informs this season, both historically and today, with Dennis Zotai of the National Museum of the American Indian. Plus, a very special conversation I've waited for a long time. The Reverend Frank Schaefer, who risked his ministry in the United Methodist Church over celebrating the same-gender marriage of his own son. We'll hear his story of church trials, abiding love, and integrity next week on State of Belief. You can make sure you won't miss a word by subscribing to our podcast at stateofbelief.com. I encourage you to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. These social platforms are a great way to share stories that you find to be important with friends and family. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. A big thank you to listeners who've made a donation this week. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And please keep State of Belief in mind the Tuesday after Thanksgiving, increasingly known as Giving Tuesday. This year, Giving Tuesday is December 2nd. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Please join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. Yes, he was.